Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 23rd of September. The current cover story on Mental Floss magazine is the five gutsiest world leaders. They're breaking the rules, changing our minds, and shaping our future. Our guest is the senior editor of Mental Floss, who wrote the cover story on world leaders. Jennifer Drapkin is joining us. And she says that these aren't all saints, but their actions have changed their nations. And moreover, these changes will affect your life. After all, if the current global economic meltdown has taught us anything, it's that we're all in this together. If we're going to climb out, we have to learn from those around us and build on their accomplishments. Some of the people on the list are unusual, probably not household names here in America, but they're fascinating people. And we're going to welcome phone calls for Jennifer as we roll along here this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Jenny. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
Great, great. I'm really excited to be back on the show.
Great.
I like it a lot.
Good, good. Well, you sound so chipper, too. You're waking everybody up here.
So that's great. Well, I'm awake. It's pretty outside. You know, good morning.
Yeah. So, obviously, there are tons and tons of world leaders, many of whom are in New York City as we speak. How is it, and you found some fascinating people. I have my favorites, but how did you narrow it down?
It was very, very hard, and I did a lot of reading. Mostly, I just wanted to pick people who'd done something unusual and had unusual backgrounds. We started thinking about this article during the election season, the most exciting election season ever in the history of election seasons. and you know, the great thing about Obama and about Hillary Clinton were that they were unusual candidates for the United States. They had unusual backgrounds, unlike any other presidential candidate who'd ever run before. So I started taking a look around the world and seeing what other countries are doing. And we're really not the first country in the world to elect someone unexpected, mm-hmm. someone who set a new precedent. But those types of elections always come from a period of change, of a period of a little bit of turmoil, and so that's how we narrowed it down. There are other great world leaders out there who are doing interesting things, but these people all have something unexpected about them, and they've changed their country. Mm-hmm. So that's how we picked them out.
Well, we may as well start with Lula, who has an absolutely riveting. Riveting background, born, in just abject poverty. Tell us the story of Lula, the president of Brazil, who, of course, doesn't need any other names because he's so popular. He's a one-name guy.
He's like Madonna.
Yeah.
I like at Lula rallies, you can hear people singing, Lula, 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 just like soccer, ole, ole. And Brazil is hosting the World Cup in a few years. They love soccer there, as we all know. So it's a big compliment, you know. He really was born into abject poverty. His father was an abusive alcoholic and had something like 23 offspring. And that's a lot of people to come out of anyone's loins. And obviously he couldn't support all of them. And Lula's mom, at one point in time said, it's enough and enough. She moved her kids out of the house and into the back room of a bar. And things were really, really bad. This is poverty in Brazil during a period of dictatorship where, there's essentially no welfare. There's no safety net for the poorest citizens. So they were kind of starving. And then one day, Lula's older brother, and I love the fact this is a true story. Lula's older brother went to the marketplace and found a bag of money. And the money had enough. It had enough money inside of it to last for three years, basically 3 years worth of money, for like a working class family. So Lula's mom took the kids, moved out to the suburbs. They still had to struggle and stuff, but that made the difference. And Lula got to have an education, got to learn how to read, and that's that's cool. That's sort of the miracle of how this man got to exist. And he didn't really care about politics much. He was a factory worker until he was 23 or 24. And his wife was 7 months pregnant. And she got sick and went to the hospital and died and lost the baby, too. And that's when he woke up and just decided he had to change his country, because in any other country in the world, this woman would have gotten some decent medical treatment, but instead she was just sort of left to die. And he, for 20 years, he was a labor organizer, a unionizer, at a time in his country when that was illegal. You couldn't unionize, and you could go to jail, you could be murdered in the middle of the night. So it was a very brave thing to do. I think in the United States right now, when you hear a union organizer, some people have very mixed emotions about that, and you know, the heroism of it has been lost. But when he was a union organizer, it was a heroic thing to do, a genuinely brave thing to do. And when Brazil finally became a democracy, he ran for president. He ran for president like 19 million times. No, he ran for president five or six times. I couldn't keep track, because sometimes he was running from jail, and you never know if that really counts, because what do you do when you're running from jail? You know, you can't really win. And eventually he won in 2003. And part of the reason it took so long for him to actually win is that even though the Brazilian people loved him as a sort of a champion of the poor and, you know, someone who's really fighting for their rights, they were terrified of electing him president because he seemed like he would be a socialist disaster, one of those people who gets elected and then, you know, businesses just flee the country because, you know, they're all scared that the government's going to take them over. And in fact, the exact opposite happened. Ever since he's been elected, ever since he served as president of Brazil, Brazil's economy has grown, and inflation has stayed low, and there seems to have been very reasonable economic growth in that country ever since they elected this socialist firebrand. Because at the end of the day, he's not an ideologue. He's one of those people who really is just trying to find the most practical solutions to help out the everyday person, and that always means compromising, and that always means being reasonable and listening. Right at this moment, he's at the UN, but he is going to go to Copenhagen to fight for Brazil to have the Olympics in 2016, because that's, you know, another way of bringing in business to the country. And he's been a very pro-business friendly socialist president, which is really cool. And he's also kept his promises to help out the poor. They started this program in Brazil called Bolsa Família, which basically pays poor people to get their kids vaccinated and send them to school. And it's helped something like 46 million people. And it's been so popular and so effective that China's copying it and India's copying it. It's just a way to directly help the poor without, you know, not giving it out for free. But as long as people take care of themselves, basically, and look towards their neighbors, they're going to get this check from the government. And that's, you know, that's who this man is. He's a pragmatist who's looking out for everybody. Mm-hmm. And very, very cool.
Did he ever get married again? Does he have a family?
He did. He got married again. In fact, he's going to Copenhagen to fight for getting the Olympics in Brazil. President Obama can't make it. He's busy. So he's sending Michelle to make the bid for him to get the Olympics in the United States. But Lula's bringing his wife. So he just said to a newspaper, you know, it's two against one. Michelle doesn't stand a chance, something like that. He did remarry and he has kids. So yeah. It's okay. It's good. Yeah. Things worked out for him. Yeah. But he has the image of being a working class rabble rouser. I mean, he smokes and he drinks and he curses and
he smokes on airplanes.
He almost prides himself in not speaking English, unlike every other world leader, because he just, you know, he makes do with the translator. He's of his country. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's him.
Yeah, what an interesting guy. I just didn't know very much about him at all, and it's amazing story. Then you contrasted very, very opposite political persuasion with the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, who's the second in the article. But she also has the, I didn't realize what her background, I love people's early stories, and I had no idea that she grew up, you know, sort of being watched East Germany. Not a real wealthy family, obviously very smart when she was very young and moved ahead, but she was living under a whole different regime.
Yes, she really was. It's funny because these two people are sort of on the opposite of the political spectrum, Angela Merkel and Lula da Silva, but in some ways they have a lot in common, which is that neither one of them are really ideologues. They're both pragmatists, and they both believe in personal freedom. She is a conservative, moderate conservative. In the United States, she'd be considered sort of a moderate Republican, pro-business, small government. But she has a background that makes those words have an entirely different meaning. She was raised in East Germany, and you know, got to experience all the horrors of growing up in East Germany. Her father was a Protestant minister, and if you worship anyone other than the state in a communist country, you're in trouble. And so he was constantly monitored by the Stasi. She was interrogated by the Stasi. Everyone in her family had a file on them. You know, it was, well, I guess everyone in East Germany had a file on them, but she was, you know, in that list. And it was a rough childhood, but she was incredibly smart, and you know, the top 1% of the top 1% of everything, and went on to become a PhD. Well, I think her degree was in physical chemistry, so I'm not really sure if that's physics or chemistry, but she sort of wound up studying metabolism and bodies, and she's super smart. And she had no ambitions politically growing up. And then one day in 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. And she did what many East Berliners did that day. She just walked across to the other side. And, you know, that day decided to go into politics because she saw the opportunities in the world. And part of the reason that she is, you know, pro-business is because she, and personal freedom, is because she sees what can happen when the state really takes over business, when, you know, when the government really controls everything. So you know, in that sense, it's a whole different meaning, really, when you can come from East Germany and you say you're for pro business and personal freedoms. And when she entered politics, that she chose to be in the conservative party in Germany, the CDU, Christian Democrats, for just that reason. She really didn't feel like she could be left wing anymore, having seen the extreme of left wing, which is, you know, communism, and she was pretty much the only woman in that party, which is why she rose to the top so quickly. It was not the party for women, and she became sort of she was known as Helmut's girl, for Helmut Kohl, because she was promoted so quickly and became such a prominent figure. And as a scientist, as someone with a real scientific background, not a fake one, but like an actual scientist, she saw the dangers of global warming very, very early, and was a leader in the Kyoto Protocol. Almost precisely, not because she really loves trees, she likes trees, but it's because she does, actually. She likes nature walks and everything. But that's not why she was so environmentally conscious early on. It's because she saw the long, long, long-term effects of damage to the environment, and ultimately it hurts the economy and it makes people poor, and you can't. It's literally unsustainable. So almost from a pro-business perspective, she picked up very early on what countries needed to do to become, well, more, to make their businesses more sustainable. And so that, I mean, that's, you know, that's kind of her. This is like a gigantic brain looking at the bigger picture. And when she was finally elected chancellor, or selected as chancellor, that's been like the dominant theme of her term, is that she sees the bigger picture of things, and no matter what the problem is, she's not going to be looking at it as a conservative. She's looking at it as just the most practical thing we can possibly do to solve the problem.
Well, how big a deal was it for Germany to have a woman governing the country? They weren't real happy about that at first,
they weren't. Well, she barely squeaked into office, and it was sort of basically there was no majority in the German parliament. So it was sort of a backroom deal that got her into office, not in a sinister way. It's just that there was no clear winner, so they, you know, we get a lot of negotiations. They have a very different system than we have in the United States. So she didn't really have much to fall back on in terms of party support, and she was a woman, and not very many people were happy about that. When she was campaigning, she put on makeup for the first time because, you know, she was just not feminine enough for the German people. And there's that's a weird catch-22 of a woman being in power, is that they have to be pretty and yet strong.
Right.
You know, we've seen it here with Hillary Clinton. It's just, how feminine do you want her to be? You know, that's because either way, she's going to get criticized. But she did. She put on makeup for the first time, and didn't want to do it. But it actually, getting a nice haircut and putting on makeup helped her numbers in the polls. And
the simple things in life, right? Oh, that's funny. How does she get along with President Obama?
It's funny. They have a lot of mutual respect, but they have very different approaches to the global financial crisis. Obama, you know, especially if you think about the last year, he really has wanted to inject a lot of money into the economy. And she was very reluctant to do that in Germany because she's terrified of inflation. And if you know German economic history, inflation has been a real problem for them in the 1920s and the 1930s, inflation got so ridiculous that a barrel full of money wouldn't buy you a newspaper, and that's kind of what led to fascism and, you know, Hitler and World War II. All of those things were sort of the result of having a horrific economy with terrifying inflation. So in Germany, being scared of inflation is like it's a different thing than it is here. You know, we don't really have that sort of visceral fear of inflation, really. It's something bad, but we're not scared that our entire country is going to collapse and possibly lead to a world war. You know, that's not something we're thinking about. So they've clashed on that, but I think it'll be interesting to see what happens at the G20 summit this week. She'll be there, and all the world leaders will be in Pittsburgh, which I think is kind of wonderful.
I know, isn't it? To imagine them all in Pittsburgh. I love it, too.
I kind of can't believe that's actually happening, and I thought it was a joke. But it's not, and I found out why. I'm sorry to get sidetracked.
No, that's fine. I don't know why
there. Pittsburgh, you have to respect Pittsburgh. It was a nasty industrial city 30 years ago, and they've really turned themselves around, and now it's a beautiful place. But I read this one quote from President Obama about why he chose to have it in Pittsburgh, which I just thought was too funny. I've been struck by how many beautiful places there are in this country that you wouldn't necessarily think are beautiful, like Pittsburgh. And that's it, you know. It's just it's this place that's turned itself around. But he couldn't quite, you know, get the words out. But he's like, "Oh, it's the most beautiful place in the country." No, that's not it. It's just some place you don't think of as beautiful.
They must be so tickled in Pittsburgh to have this summit there.
Who saw this coming? No one did.
Oh,
no one saw this coming.
Yeah.
You know, and having tickled and confused, deeply confused. I just learned the Andy Warhol Museum was in Pittsburgh, and there was a quote from the curator that he's from Pittsburgh, but he never wanted to say he was from Pittsburgh. And the curator said something like, "Yeah, if Andy Warhol could really turn over in his grave, he would have rolled all the way to China by now." I mean, it was just.
We need to pause for a moment. We'll return and take phone calls. Our guest is Jennifer Drapkin. She is senior editor at Mental Floss and has written a highly interesting cover story for this current issue, September-October issue of Mental Floss, The Five Gutsiest World Leaders. They're breaking the rules, changing our minds, and shaping our future. They're also interesting. We spent almost the first half hour on the first two. But we will move on, and we'll ask you the question, who do you think are the gutsiest leaders, and define that term as you will, who are governing now? Our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And we want to update you. We've had 492 people now donating to our Take Days Off campaign. If we get 700 donations, and this is worth your while and everybody's while here, we're going to take a day off the fall pledge drive. So we're close to that with 492, but not yet there. So we please invite you to go to WPR.org to donate now and take some days off the pledge drive. Well, welcome phone calls for Jenny. Our lines are open. Feel free to join the conversation. You may want to add your two cents to the conversations we've already had about Lula and Angela Merkel. There are others who she describes as pretty gutsy guys and gals. So to you, if you want to call us, and to more discussion in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We certainly welcome your phone calls. If you want to listen, I assume you're listening. If you want to not call in, that's fine. But if you'd like to join the conversation, I'd love to hear your response of who you think are the gutsiest world leaders and what you think of the conversation concerning two of them, the conversation we've just had. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm not taking these in the order in which they appear in the magazine, but perhaps the ones that I have found most interesting. The president of Chile, there's another story, huh?
Yes, she is another story. Michelle Bachelet, she had another sort of heroic and strange tale of how she became the president of this country. Chile, if we remember our history a little bit, had a horrible dictator, Pinochet, about 30 years ago in the 70s. And he tortured a large portion of the country, about 30,000 people, which included Michelle, her mother, and her father. Her father actually died as a result of the torture. And she and her mother were also both tortured. And for being liberals in this very conservative regime and politically active, she was sort of a hippie. I think that's probably the best way to describe her. She had a band. They played Bob Dylan songs and Joan Baez songs, and it was called Los Clop Clop, which I think is a great name for a hippie band. And she rose to power, first being a health minister, and then, more interestingly, being a minister of defense. And you might think, why would you put this hippie lady as a minister of defense? Precisely because she had been a victim of torture, and she was very much responsible for bridging the gap between the civilians and the military, and making the Chilean people feel comfortable with their military again. Because if this woman, who actually had been tortured by the military, could feel confident and good about the people protecting her country, then anyone could. So that's sort of how she became a popular figure. And there are other things about her that are very unusual for a presidential candidate in a very conservative country. One of them is that she's a divorcee. She's a single mother of three kids. She's an agnostic. She definitely, in the United States, that would never go over well. You certainly couldn't get elected into office saying that you didn't believe in a God. But she does, and she says she believes in love and people, and that even with that campaign of free, basic, not free love, but love, got her elected president of Chile, which is sort of a little unheard of, really. I mean, she would whip out her guitar at rallies and sing.
Sing Michelle Maybelle.
Michelle Maybelle, yeah. The Beatles song. Well, she didn't sing that. People would sing that to her, but because that would be a strange thing to sing about yourself. But
right.
she was still elected. And much kind of like Lula da Silva, when you put someone in power like that, you never really know what they're going to do. And in some ways, she turned out to be a very conservative leader fiscally. Chile has an interesting policy that I think we really could learn a lot from. They essentially have a rainy day fund, which kind of works like this. If copper is good, the prices of copper are high, and copper is very important to Chile's economy, and there's steady economic growth, the government will save a large portion of the surplus in a fund that they promise not to spend. And when she became into office a few years ago, the economy was in great shape. They had a great surplus, and she saved it, which is what she was supposed to do. But almost everyone in the country hated her for it because they wanted her to spend the money on them. So, students protested, hospital workers protested, just about anyone who had a job somewhat related to the government protested that she wouldn't spend the money. But it was a rainy day fund. And then, as we all know, the economy, the global economy collapsed, and she started spending it this last year. And Chile is actually in really good shape compared to the rest of the world in terms of how it's been handling this crisis. And her numbers went back up. Now she's at a 73% approval rating, which is it's a ridiculously high number. And it's precisely because she did the hard thing and didn't spend money when everyone was telling her to,
right,
and kind of saved her country. So she's another fascinating one to me.
She sure
just
is.
She had this unusual background and wound up not doing anything that people expected her to do.
But she only has what? I didn't know in Chile you could only be president for 4 years. So she
4 years.
You can't run again.
She only has 3 months left in office, and then she's out. But it's because they had horrible dictators who took power for too long, really.
Right.
They don't want anyone in power for too long. And I think that's something you see often in countries where that's been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Before we move on completely from Angela Merkel, there was something else I was thinking about.
Sure.
This last year, this is a woman who's a scientist who never wore makeup before she was running for office, who, doesn't really like to shop, all of those things. They came out with an Angela Merkel Barbie that looks absolutely nothing like her.
Oh!
I mean, it looks like Barbie,
No.
But she said she liked it. She approves of the doll. And I can't help thinking it's because there's an election in Germany this weekend. She'll probably be reelected, but she couldn't quite come out and speak against Barbie, which, she's a ballsy woman, but not that.
Oh, that's
That was
funny.
Apparently too much for her.
It's funny. Is that only available in Germany, or can it be purchased here?
No, with the internet,
if you can get your own.
Callers really want, the listeners really want to order one, I bet they could find it. Now I kind of want one, but
you of all people should have one after all this work.
It's true.
I feel like I should send you one.
It's true. That should be my holiday bonus.
Yes, it should. Yes.
But it'd be interesting to see how she handles the summit in Pittsburgh this week. She'll be asking probably for I'm guessing a crackdown on tax havens and sort of a regulation of hedge funds, and that's most European leaders are kind of asking that in the United States right now.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see if it happens. I don't know if it will.
Let's go to some callers. We start with, is it Jana from Green Bay?
Hi there.
Hi. Hi.
I appreciate your knowledge on some of the South American countries. We just don't hear about them very often. And I was wondering, the Mexican president, I have heard recently just on the street in conversation that he's the first president to go against the drug mafia, and he's replacing the guards, the border guards, with his military and things like that. Do you know anything about him, or...
I do know a little bit. I've been sort of trying to catch up on this. I don't trust anything when it comes to Mexico and the border guards, because it seems I'm from Texas, and I don't see who we could possibly be replacing them with, because everyone there is on the take when it comes to drugs going across the border. I think you'd have to fly in people from another country. I know that's very cynical, but it's just my personal, I read a little bit about this, and I don't know who could possibly monitor that border, because everyone's been taking so much money for so long.
Anything else, John? She's no longer there. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the gutsiest leaders in the world. If you want to join the conversation, lines are open for you. Moving on to the president of Uganda.
So he's another one who he's not a saint, definitely. When I wrote the line, "They're not all saints," I was thinking of him.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely did something to save his country, and it's something I think we actually have learned from it in the United States, maybe without realizing it. In Uganda, in the 1980s, he became president for the first time. He was a freedom fighter who helped fight against Idi Amin, and then took office. Usually that doesn't work out so well. If you look at African history, you sort of just get one freedom fighter becoming a dictator after another, and they rarely step down from power. And in fact, in his inaugural address, he said that was Africa's problem, that, you know, people seize power and they won't ever step down. And when he became president, there was really a lot of hope for him, because he restored democracy to local level and then did something really fascinating when it came to fighting AIDS. In the late 80s, he sent some of his soldiers to Cuba for training, and his buddy Fidel Castro called him up and said, "Buddy, I think you have a problem." They tested Uganda soldiers, and it turned out that a third of them were HIV positive. And as opposed to doing pretty much what everyone else in the world was doing at that time, Museveni made fighting HIV in his country. This is the late 80s. This is not, you know, in the United States at this time, we're still calling it the gay plague. He made it a national agenda, put it on the national agenda, and made it a point of pride to fight AIDS in his country. And with almost no budget, he managed to keep it from turning into an epidemic. And the way he did it was that instead of just promoting condoms or just promoting abstinence, which tends to be the take that we have in this country, that it's, you know, it's condom use or abstinence and there's no other way to solve it, he adopted a policy that I think is really funny and effective called zero grazing, which basically says have as much sex as you like, maybe even have sex with more than one person, but really limit your sexual partners and keep it close to home. So, you know, your wife and your mistress, but not your wife and your mistress and 20 prostitutes. That's unreasonable. And it worked. And, you know, they had little girls on the radio every morning in this ad saying, "Oh, Daddy, don't die. I'm too young. Be faithful." You know, just to promote the idea.
That's pretty creative.
Monogamy. And it really worked in that country. The funny thing is, if you think about the United States, that's almost what we did here in the 90s without even really realizing it. Culturally, you know, it was the end of this idea that, you know, the free love of the 60s and the 70s ended in the 90s here because of AIDS, because there was sort of a national awareness that you can't have as many sexual partners as you want. That's not healthy. And, you know, that's kind of what we did here without realizing it. But in Uganda, it became a matter of policy. And it kept AIDS from spreading throughout the country.
This figure is amazing, you cite. By 2001, only 5% of Ugandans were living with HIV.
Yes.
That's so low.
It's. I mean, for Africa, that's really good.
Compared to what it was, yeah. You know, amazing.
That's astounding. And it's funny because recently, in the last 10 years, that number has crept up just a little bit because because he hasn't been as effective as a leader, basically. He's stayed in power way too long, which is the problem with African leaders. He never stepped down, and he's become increasingly militaristic, which is why he's no longer a saint, unfortunately. He really has. People were praising him in the 90s for becoming this new African leader, this new type of African leader. But in the last 10 years, he's proven that he's actually the old type of African leader who just won't relinquish power and becomes corrupt. And it has made his campaign against AIDS less effective as well.
Yeah.
But it's still by no means an epidemic there. It's not the crisis that it is in other countries.
Dave from Madison. Hi. Dave, are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Hi. Dave.
Yeah. I'm getting feedback. Okay. Hello? Okay. Now, what your guest just said just rattled me. She stated the leader of Chile, she was tortured because she was a liberal, and she was tortured by a conservative. Now, I would like to ask your guest what she thinks that made Pinochet a conservative.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I guess I'm not talking about liberal and conservative in the way we use it in the United States to describe our policies. It was a radically different term back then in Chile. So before Pinochet came into power, they had Salvador Allende was the elected president of Chile, and he was a socialist. He was very left wing, and Bachelet's family supported him. And what I guess I mean by liberal in that sense was that they did nationalize certain aspects of the Chilean economy, and then when Pinochet took power, he undid all of that and was pro-business, but in a way that in the United States we just would never even consider being, which is to say just supporting the business class without at all considering the rights of the workers. I mean, we're not into child labor here anymore. You know, we have rules, and that's not what was going on in Chile at that time. So I'm talking about very extreme. She was tortured because her family was on the opposite extreme of the extreme political spectrum that was controlling Chile at the time.
Thanks very much for the call. The number is 800-486-8655. Now, the fifth is somebody who's not really a household name. In fact, I'll bet if I ask people who the president of Taiwan was, very few people would be able to answer this. But he's really, you know, your story, I love your whole article because it's so fascinating that, you know, I had no idea that he was campaigning on this great China market, and it has really moved toward a free movement of goods between Taiwan and China for years and years, great animosity between those nations.
Right. So China and Taiwan are, you know, if you haven't stopped to think about it, they're fascinating pair. They're a fascinating set. And we're talking here about President Ma Ying-jeou, of Taiwan. And there are two countries, sort of. Taiwan is technically speaking a part of China, even though culturally and economically speaking they are completely separate. But he has moved very gingerly towards making some sort of a compromise between the two nations that are even part of the same country, but they're technically at war with each other. So that's
both they're both technically at war with each other and technically part of the same country, which makes it very hard to have diplomatic relations. You don't really, no one knows what to say at meetings. Do they want to get closer together? Do they want to get farther apart? It's impossible to tell. But he came up with this way of phrasing things that made it much easier for China and Taiwan to do business. It's the idea of the one China economy or the one China market, which is kind of like the European Union, or at least that's the goal, that they have this free flow of commerce and people. You can go back and forth between the countries now very easily, which you were not able to do before. Direct flights from Beijing to Taipei were impossible. But he made it so that they were possible, again, by having this concept introduced that basically says we're two different people, but we can love each other and do business with each other and have family on the other side because we're also one people. And to me, that's really interesting. And we should care as people in the United States because, technically speaking, these two countries are at war. They're still engaged in a civil war. They have been for 60 years, but there's no fighting. They just haven't made peace with each other. But should real fighting ever occur, and it is possible, China has 40,000 or 4,000 missiles pointed right at Taiwan, we have to step in and defend Taiwan. We've sworn to. There are various sites in the world where World War III could erupt, and this is one of them. So we really want these two countries to be getting along because it's good for us. And with this new president and his very careful phrasing, it seems like we'll never have to worry. Well, we won't have to worry about World War III in this age or era of the world for quite some time.
Hmm. More phone calls in a moment. The five gutsiest leaders in the world, the cover story of Mental Floss. The author is with us this hour on the Ideas Network. We go back to phone calls for Jenny. Scott from La Crosse is next. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Kathleen. Hello, guest.
Hi.
I'm not from Pennsylvania or Pittsburgh or anything. I think it's kind of, I've been there a couple of times, so I think it's kind of a cool city.
I've never been there.
Nice valley, you know, and kind of hilly. Actually, I grew up on the West Coast, and it reminds me a little bit of San Francisco in the style of architecture and the hills and all that, but that's not why I called. I have for a long time have harbored a theory. The one thing that has really hindered a lot of progress in this country in a lot of areas is the fact that we really don't have neighbors that we can learn from.
Mm-hmm.
For example, you know, if you're living in some place like Belgium and you look around and you see what the Germans are doing or you see what the Dutch are doing, you're really aware. I mean, they're right next door, and if they're doing something your government isn't or your country isn't, you go, well, why can't we do that? And, you know, we don't pay attention to Canada, and we don't emulate Mexico. So my question is, what kind of impact are these leaders having on their neighbors? I mean, are people looking at the things they're doing and going, hey, that's a good idea?
Mm. The answer is yes. It's easiest to see in Brazil, because of Bolsa Família, and it's an incredibly popular program to help out the poor. And there, you know, the neighbors are definitely looking. The thing about the United States is that I completely agree with you. We don't look around at our neighbors, but the definition of neighbors has really changed now that you know you really can look anywhere. You know, we all have the internet, we all have satellites and live TV. And the people who are emulating Brazil the most are countries that are like Brazil in the way that their economy is growing, so China and India. And that's one way in which there's a cool program in one place and then it's spreading to somewhere else. And Chile is the same way. They have a retirement program in which basically by law you're required to give 10% of your salary and put it in this retirement program, and it just comes out. And when you retire, you get the money. And you know, we've considered doing things like that in the United States. to sort of help with Social Security and Social Security issues. But other countries have also emulated that. Chile's interesting like that. They come up with their own little programs. And I think with their sort of rainy day fund, it's the same thing. I think other countries are going to emulate that because it's now worked so well in the time of an actual global financial meltdown to have savings. Yes, they learn from each other in a way that we don't necessarily do. Of course, we're trying to right now, with the healthcare reform, we are definitely looking to other countries, to try and remodel our healthcare system. And it is interesting when you start looking at healthcare in different countries and all the different types of models, because you know, the United States is the one country that doesn't provide, one industrialized country that doesn't provide health care to all of its citizens. And we kind of tend to think of universal health care as being one system that other countries have, which is not true. All these other countries have all these different systems. And if you look at what they're doing in Congress right now, you can see that it resembles other countries a great deal, but not any one specific country.
Mm. Anything else, Scott?
Well, yeah, am I picking up here that you are actually optimistic that we're moving to a point where if it wasn't invented here, we don't want to know about it?
I think we are. I really do. I really think that that is something that is happening right now. You know, Obama's he's addressing the UN this morning, and then there'll be the summit in Pittsburgh, and his address is there's no word for it yet, but I guess maybe globalist or universalist address, basically saying that we're all in this together. We all have to learn from each other. We can't get out of this without relying on one another. And this is the address he's making to the leaders of the world. And essentially the line is, if you're blaming the United States for causing this problem, that's fine, you know, but then you can't also expect us to single-handedly fix it. You know, we caused it, but we can't fix it all by ourselves. And he's calling on the leaders of the world to help. And so I think that we really are listening more to each other, because we have to, because when it comes to regulating the financial markets, we can't have a different set of laws in every country. It won't work, but there's too much business going on between nations, and there's too much cheating that can happen if there's one nation that doesn't follow the rules, like the tax havens in the Cayman Islands and in Switzerland and all of these areas of the world where you can kind of cheat if you just go there and do part of your business there, not your whole business, mm-hmm. but your banking. And I think that we have to start paying attention to what other nations are doing. I don't think it would happen any other way. I don't think we just start paying attention because it seems like fun, you know. If we weren't in a state of crisis, that wouldn't happen.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. It was delightful. Ron is next from Toma. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. I happen to fly on about a three-plus hour flight with a graduate student who was from Chile, mm-hmm. going to Italy to study, and actually had some very close family in Chicago. We flew from Miami to Chicago and had one stop in between, but that's what made the flight longer. But we had quite a discussion about the Chile's past, and she indicated that it was a very tumultuous time, but she didn't really discuss it with her grandparents and parents to any extent, because they really didn't want to talk about it, and there were apparently even members of their family that were on both sides of the conflict at that time in the 60s and 70s. I thought that was quite interesting that being a young adult like that and very well educated, that she really didn't want to discuss it. We talked about many other things, but didn't want to discuss that.
Jenny.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting. I think that's part of the reason that Michelle Bachelet was so popular, is because she initiated a dialogue that no one really wanted to, the people wanted to have, but they didn't know how to have. because you did have torturers living alongside the people they had tortured, and it was a quiet tension for many, many years in the country, and that only started to break down in the last 10 years when they started to have, they started to put people on trial who had tortured other people, and they started to trust the military again. But it's still, any place that has a history that is so sad in many ways, you're going to have people who have trouble discussing it and don't want to discuss it. She still doesn't discuss the torture that she actually experienced. The center she was taken to was a really strange one. It was basically a country villa that had beautiful swimming pools and marble staircases and torture chambers in the basement. And, women were raped and electrocuted. And she won't say what happened to her specifically, but probably something like that. And but what she also said when she was running for office is that we have to start the healing process. In order to start the healing process, we have to talk about it. She is a doctor, and the analogy she usually uses is only clean wounds heal. Mm-hmm. So you have to clean out the wound. But that's a process. That's an ongoing process in the country. It certainly hasn't stopped.
Thanks, Ron, for the call. Well, we're out of time, Jenny. We never got to the also-rans, too, but we'll tell people to go to the magazine for this. Thank you so much for being with us. Next time, please play the tin whistle for us.
You read that.
I did, yeah.
Okay.
All right.
I will. Thanks,
Jenny. Jenny Drapkin, she's the author of the cover story piece in the current issue, September-October, of Mental Floss magazine, The Five Gutsiest World Leaders. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks, everybody, for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Franz DeWall will be one of our guests tomorrow, actually, during this particular hour. So I hope you'll listen. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.